Hola, Sue. So it looks like it's afternoon again. I guess I have the same question this afternoon that I have this morning. How many would love to enjoy silence in the afternoon and not have guided meditations? And how many would like to have guided meditations? I think I had a precognitive moment there. I think the shamatha is working. Let's try it. You know, if you don't have only one example, that is not enough. Let's see if my precognition is really working. How many would like to have free ice cream at lunch and dinner every day? I'm now clearly psychic, yeah? All right, I was afraid you might say that. And so I thought, moving on from the utterly ridiculous to the not so ridiculous, as we then begin the cycle, starting, of course, with loving kindness, as you know, in the guided meditations I've offered thus far, as much as I've been able to, I've tried to bring as much wisdom from the Buddhist tradition, I think it's simply wisdom, into these practices, so we don't simply have two different types, you know, the wisdom over here and compassion way over yonder. And so as we venture into the practice this afternoon, which when I'm actually leading it, it will be few words, because I know some of you, well, myself included, like to have it not too complicated. What I would encourage you to address in this afternoon session is a simple question, now that we've addressed the issue of ice cream or no ice cream, is what kind of a universe we're living in. That one. That question. What kind of a place is this? I mean, the cosmos at large. And because actually I think this is enormously relevant to the practice of loving kindness with respect to ourselves and others. What is our view? What do we think is going on? And so there's one view, and I think it's a very intelligent view. I think it's profoundly mistaken, but I think it's very intelligent and it has a very broad basis of data upon which it's erected. And it's really half of the Cartesian view. Descartes himself was a profoundly, so I'm going to go on for a little while, and then when we actually meditate, very few words. Okay, but I think this is maybe not, hopefully not time wasted. But Descartes himself was a profoundly religious man, as really so many of the great thinkers, philosophers, scientists of his era were, devout Roman Catholic. But when he portrayed the physical universe, which of course he utterly assumed God created, an omnibenevolent, omnipotent God created, I think that really never came in serious doubt in his mind, he portrayed it as an absolutely objective universe, that was basically a great big machine modeled after a clock. So I think it's quite well known. And that model has really stuck. It's stuck. A very recent book, very well-known book, was The Blind Watchmaker by the geneticist Richard Dawkins, I think, wrote it. So that metaphor continues, but now it's a blind watchmaker because there's nobody there, and certainly nobody compassionate there. And so if we look at physics, the view of physics is simply this is a great big mindless machine. It arose, nobody knows quite how, but it came out of simple space, time, mass, energy. That's the whole show. And there are regularities or laws in nature, but there is nothing in the whole of nature that is meaningful out there. There is nothing ethical. The word ethics has no referent in reality. It's a great big mindless machine, which at the subatomic level is chaotic, but on the macro level is very regular. And so everything that happens here for us human beings on this planet here, and it's a little microcosm within the universe, is all subject to those laws of physics. And that's what we are. We are physical organisms operating according to the laws of physics in a large physical universe. Welcome home. So that's one view. Of course, physics isn't the only science in town. We have biology, and biology portrays us utterly and totally as animals. And there are only two prime directives for the evolution of all forms of life on this planet, presumably on all other planets, and that is survive and procreate. That's it. There's nothing else to it. If you survive and procreate, you're a success. If you don't, you're not a success. That's just it, because you don't pass on your genes. You're a dead end, right? So that's it. And so then we are physical human beings, but we're also animals, which means we are genetically driven by very, very, very deep evolutionary conditioning over millions of years to do the two things that we're really conditioned to do, and that is survive and procreate, and everything else is window dressing. Religion, philosophy, art, music, all of this is really evolutionarily conducive. I guess people who are great musicians get laid more often. I'm not quite sure, but you know, whatever comes up, it had to be somehow helpful. In modern music, that's definitely true. But for Bach and Beethoven, I don't know. I kind of doubt it. I don't think they had. I don't think they're very lucky. And so there we have biology, and now we know the mind sciences are just up to their neck in biology, with many, not all, absolutely not all, but many psychologists, evolutionary psychologists, but many academic psychologists across the boards really saying, yes, we are human beings, yes, we have psyches, but really it's all rooted in biology, and there we are. And so there's one view. And it is certainly possible to develop loving kindness within the context of that. There's certainly a lot of grounds for compassion. If this is all we are, then we're pretty pathetic beings. There's one view. There's another major view, which is dominant in multiple religions, especially the Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And that is that everything I just said is absolutely false. That is in terms of that being a complete and accurate portrayal of the universe. No, the universe was created by an omnipotent and omnibenevolent Allah, the merciful, God who is love. This echoes throughout the Jewish tradition, the Hindu, the Christian tradition, and of course also in theistic traditions in Asia. But there we do have especially if we look at the Abrahamic religions, in each of which reincarnation has occurred, and in each of which it has been embraced for some period, and in each of which it's been pretty much jettisoned by the mainstream. But it's been there all in all three of them. But if you throw out reincarnation, the notion that we do again get re-embodied, then you need to understand how is it that we have things like, well, natural disasters and the type of diseases we do and so forth and the many tragedies that simply happen to us that are simply not human created at all. And how is this possible? And of course, it goes to mysterious are the ways of the Lord is pretty much the final answer. There's not much more to it. That God is you just have to believe God is omnipotent. God does create tsunamis and earthquakes and naturally cause forest fires and so forth, and diseases of all kinds and premature death and accidents. And God is really behind it all because he's the grand designer, the architect, and the running operating engineer. And so you look at that and you simply say, well, mysterious are the ways of the Lord when your infant child dies of leukemia. God is taking him home. So they come up with some account, and these are highly intelligent people, so I hope no ridicule is read into my words. But I think it does call for a lot of soul-searching for people who face this, and it has for centuries. So there's that view that God is ultimately responsible for everything that's happening in the world out there to us. We are responsible for our own behavior. So there's one view. There's we can call it the early Buddhist view, we can call it the Theravada view, because it's the major proponent of this view, that there is nobody out there who did it to us, there is no external creator who created the universe, there's nobody punishing us for our virtues and punishing for our vices and rewarding us for our virtues, whereas of course that is absolutely integral to the theistic views, that God is big time, major, how do you say, job description for God is punishing and rewarding. In Buddhist tradition on the whole, universally, that notion is simply rejected for the lack of any evidence whatsoever. Not that there's a God, but there's a God who did that. That there is actually a God who is punishing and rewarding people according to his own particular religion, whether it's Buddhism, Judaism, or what have you. So in the Theravada view, no creator. So macrocosm, microcosm, no superego out there who creates and rewards, who intervenes, punishes, and so forth, and no little mini-god in here who's in charge of the little mini-cosmos of our body-mind and is acting as this, you know, how do you say, prime director outside of the system. So how do we explain, then, natural calamities? And how do we explain all the things that happen to us that are utterly beyond our control? Not things that we've contributed to, like economic collapses. Well, they're human created. They're not created by nature. And the answer to that is karma. It really is karma, which makes absolutely no sense if without the context of repeated lives, to try to understand what happens to us in this lifetime in terms of karma, just winds up being psychotic immediately. Right? And so this is integral, and so taking very seriously and homogeneously, as you sow, so shall you reap, that the tragedies, the misfortunes we encounter in this lifetime were caused by prior causes and conditions. We're responsible for them, whether the seeds were sown in this lifetime or in most cases, previous lifetimes. And then recognizing this is the nature of samsara. And the notion of bondage, the ocean of misery, this many, many metaphors come up, then the prime directive is get release, gain release from karma and klesha, klesha driving karma, which perpetuates the whole cycle. So there is really core Buddhist teachings. And that's pretty much it. And then get out and never come back is the end game. That's the ultimate thing that one can aspire for, which the Buddha taught, and many, many of his disciples realized. When we go to Mahayana, this whole depiction of samsara, this wheel of conditioned existence, nature of karma and kleshas, all embraced. It's all embraced. It's all there. But something further is introduced, which now sets it apart from everything else. It never goes back to the God of Abraham, or kind of an Abrahamic or theistic notion of God the creator and the God the punisher and the rewarder. That never makes its way into Buddhism. But nor is it simply, it's a great big mindless, meaningless, horrible machine from which we need to escape as quickly as possible. And so with that Theravada view, really, the point, there is no point to samsara. It just came out of ignorance, and what we do is just get out and don't look back. But then you wonder, well, why did it happen in the first place? And the answer is there was no first place. And that's it. That's it. Get out, don't come back. And if you can bring other people with you, all the better. Mahayana doesn't leave it at that, certainly doesn't go to the theistic route, but brings in this notion of Dharmakaya, that the Buddha mind, a truly omnipresent mind, an omnibenevolent mind, but crucially, absolutely crucially, not an omnipotent mind. So the mind of the Buddha, Dharmakaya, primordial consciousness, Buddha nature, pristine awareness, an omnipresent, a transcendent, a non-local, an atemporal, ultimate dimension of consciousness, the wellspring of all virtue, the ground of samsara and nirvana, not a person, not other than ourselves, not an outside creator, not a punisher and not a rewarder, and yet divine, certainly the word divine is relevant. It is our essential nature, which we find reflections of this in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, sometimes clearly, sometimes not so clearly, in Mahayana Buddhism, very clearly. But now in this view, there is now a juxtaposition. It's not the theistic problem, what do they call it, theodicy, of how can an omnipotent and omnibenevolent God create a universe with such an inconceivable amount of suffering? How is that possible? That's the problem of theodicy, as I recall. That doesn't come up in Buddhism, because Buddha didn't do it. Buddha didn't create misery. Buddha didn't create delusion or mental afflictions or karma. Buddha didn't create the universe as some agent out there who did it to us. In the Kalachakra Tantra, it says, there is no Buddha apart from sentient beings. Quite interesting. There's no Buddha apart from sentient beings. That's not to say there's no Buddha, there's only sentient beings. It's just that there's no Buddha apart from, absolutely separate from sentient beings. Nobody's doing it to us. What is happening? It's not happening blindly, as in the materialistic view, just for no reason at all, go figure, just nature. Nor is it happening somebody doing it to us. There's karma at play, but the juxtaposition here, and here's where I think I'd like to kind of wrap this up. The juxtaposition here is twofold, and in various ways, Christians and others have dealt with this as well, when they speak of blessing and grace, as well as laws of nature, and the moral laws laid down in the Bible and so forth, is that on the one hand, in the Buddhist view, all Buddhist views, that is all schools, as we sow, so shall we reap. That is, what we're experiencing now is strongly conditioned by our past lives and so forth, but in each moment we are active agents, and we are now formulating our future. And we're not simply grinding, we're not little cogs in a wheel, just doing what we have to do because it's predetermined by the past. Emphatically not true. There is no school of Buddhism, and the Buddha himself explicitly refuted that. That we have no freedom because all of our actions in the present moment are completely predetermined by our previous actions. Absolute rejection of that notion. Nor is it chaotic, nor is there an individual, separate, independent self who's making free choices outside of the matrix of causality. So it's a subtle point. I could spend a lot of time on that. I've lectured on it. I've written about it, the whole issue of free will in Buddhism. I won't try to elaborate that on that right now, but what I think is worthwhile doing here is that we have this juxtaposition. On the one hand, the blessings, the dynamic aspect, the dynamic, spontaneous, and infinite displays of Buddha mind in the world now, and that's core Mahayana view, Vajrayana view, Dzogchen view, that the Buddha is not inert, he's not simply waiting for us to all catch up to his enlightenment, but actually the prime directive, the whole theme of bodhicitta before and after enlightenment is to bring all sentient beings away from suffering, out of suffering and its causes, bring each one to their own fulfillment. And that not only is the motivation of the bodhisattva, but it is what being a Buddha is all about until all sentient beings are free. So the Buddha's, this is why it's said that it takes three countless eons of accumulating merit to develop that type of power, so that it basically, that it manifests spontaneously until all sentient beings are indeed liberated. So on the one hand, karma. Nobody else did it to us. We have sown and we have reaped. But it's not just in a great big machine, and we're just kind of waiting to see when we get sledgehammered next by our past karma. We are creating right now fresh karma, but we can also be recipients of the blessings, the dynamic compassion, the activities of the Buddhas here and now. And so it's these two waves flowing together. The waves for the dynamic activity of the Buddhas and the waves of our own karma coming together. And one can ask, well, it sounds like these are two very different forces. Our karma is mixed of all kinds. But the power, the compassion of the Buddha is omnibenevolent. It's only kind. It's not here to punish anybody for anything. And so how do these two interface? And that is a very subtle point. And it would be very easy to go on at length about that. I think now's not the time. But just to raise that as now food for thought, if you want to consider this worldview, perhaps it is your worldview. Maybe you would like to simply look at it, investigate it, or maybe you're sold on one of the other options, whatever. As we know, you can practice four immeasurables without adopting this or any other particular worldview. But where I'm really going with this is the following. And that is within the context of one lifetime. If we see who is fortunate, just to which people do really good things happen. They wind up just having a wonderful spouse, they have really healthy children, they get really lucky or just fortunate in their workplace, in education, in health, in living in peaceful places and so forth. Some people are enormously fortunate. Other people just get whacked, just beat up from the time they're born. And they just get beat up, and then they die. And they just died of being beaten to death by all the terrible things that happen to them. And so, if we try to look at this just within the context of one life, there's no rhyme or reason. I think there's just no rhyme or reason. I mean, there's some causality. Within a single life, if we act with kindness and compassion and so forth, something comes back. But don't think it'll protect you from cancer or from getting murdered or being hit by a sniper or not being killed in a tsunami and so forth and so on and so on. There's no evidence for that. So absolutely, of course, do your best anyway. But don't expect that all good fortune is going to happen to you in this lifetime because you've been virtuous in this lifetime, because the evidence doesn't suggest that, right? Or that if in this lifetime one is just an absolute scoundrel, don't think that you'll necessarily die young. You know, you might really live a nice long life and healthy and have a very happy family and reap the riches and be respected by many of people of your sort, and maybe you can get away with an awful lot. You might be able to get away with an awful lot, you know? You can fool a lot of people a lot of the time. And so within one lifetime, no rhyme or reason, right? So it's a crapshoot. If insofar as we really focus on hedonic well-being, if that's all, just basically good luck. Good luck, because within the context of one lifetime, that's pretty much it. Try hard and hope for the best, but try hard and you might get just whacked, just, you know, hammered. Don't try hard at all, you may be incredibly lucky. There's no telling, right? And don't expect any help from the universe. That is, if you're just focusing on hedonic, don't expect the universe to rally around. There's no evidence for it. But if you just try really hard to get really rich, somehow that's going to make you lucky. Hard work will work, but no telling. So there you have that, hedonic. In other words, just don't expect anything. Just try hard, hope for the best. Maybe you'll get lucky, maybe not. you'll probably have better luck if you try hard. Although some people don't try hard and they still get lucky. When it comes to the pursuit, especially insofar as it's one of those gradients where the like iron filings orienting towards a magnet, as your whole life becomes oriented around and towards prime directive, highest priority, the realization of genuine happiness. And then it's not just genuine happiness for oneself, as if one were autonomous, independent, and unrelated to those around one, but as it becomes oriented towards genuine happiness for oneself in interrelationship with the others. Genuine happiness, the highest happiness that one may realize in order to turn that outwards and be of greatest possible benefit. Along this whole trajectory of pursuing genuine happiness, then here's a hypothesis, and it's actually there in the core teachings, that is early teachings, we can call them now Theravada teachings, the major preservers of them. It's there. It's not just a Mahayana add-on. It's very explicit. I think it's more developed, it's more obvious, explicit in the Mahayana tradition. But it's clearly there in the teachings of the historical Buddha recorded in the Pali Canon. And that is, insofar as we really orient ourselves towards the pursuit of genuine happiness, towards liberation, towards enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And here's where the shoe's going to finally drop, what I'm really getting at. Reality rises up to meet us. Reality rises up to meet us, insofar as it's not just attachment to this life and the mundane. It's really tapping into, oriented towards genuine happiness, the inner resources, the true causes of happiness, attending to and seeking to attenuate the true causes of suffering. Recognizing the true causes of suffering are rooted in delusion and ignorance, and the true causes of happiness are rooted in wisdom and insight. It's a crucial point. Insofar as our lives just become utterly galvanized towards, polarized towards, oriented towards the pursuit of genuine happiness, liberation, enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, the hypothesis reality rises up to meet us. Reality comes in waves. We wind up being fortunate in this regard. And that is one fortuitous circumstance arises. We meet just the people we need to meet just when we need to meet them. We find the book, we find the companion, we find the place, we find the sustenance, we find the environment. Everything that is needed from moment to moment, day to day, year to year, decade to decade. You call it luck, you call it luck, you call it, this isn't luck, this is a pattern. And it's a pattern, and it's a pattern, and it's a pattern, and it's a pattern. This is not random. There's something going on here. And it's not localized to my friends, to human population. It seems to be coming from a deep source, reality. And now I'll try to summarize it. Insofar as our yearning, our fundamental yearning, of that of all sentient beings, to find happiness and to be free of suffering, insofar as that prime directive of all sentient beings, more prime than survival and procreation. Anybody who's keeping his eyes open should know that. There are many people happy not to procreate. I'm one of them. Doesn't make me special, but I'm one of them. I have no urge at all to procreate. And survival, many, many, many cases, choose non-survival over survival for marvelous reasons, for noble reasons, and sometimes not so noble reasons. So, insofar as our yearning for genuine happiness, our yearning for just happiness and the freedom of suffering is rooted in reality, not towards these illusory phantoms of hedonic pleasures, which are mere facsimiles and icons, but towards the actual happiness itself, actual freedom itself, and not simply the anesthetic. As our motivations are authentic and realistic, reality rises up to meet us. We are being real. Reality corresponds. It says, but that should be the case. If our motivations are realistic, then we should get help from reality. If our motivations are unrealistic, why should we get any help from reality? Why should we? It's not realistic. It's out of whack. It's out of alignment. But insofar as we're aligning ourselves with that which is true, then why wouldn't then truth set us free So as we go into the loving kindness, and then I'll happily get to way cut down on speech, I invite you to consider this. This can very easily, everything I just said here, could easily, about, you know, about this Mahayana view, this Buddhist view, could very easily be said, this is one of those religious beliefs. I've heard about those. This is one of those, but this is for religious believers. Like, oh yeah, I've heard about those people. They're really optimistic. That's one way of viewing it, where you just kind of believe it and then close your eyes and carry on. I've never found that very interesting myself. And I'm not really capable of it. Just kind of, okay, I think I'm going to believe this. Okay, I do. I don't know how to do that. I've been very, very, very good at that. I don't know how to do it. So I don't know about that. But to take this as a hypothesis and say, well, let's try it on like a cloak, like a new garment. Let's try on this view. I will watch my motivations, knowing on some occasion they're going to be just hedonic, in which case don't expect any help from morality. Just, you know, do your best. On other occasions, I'll see, here's a motivation that is core. This motivation is real. This is deep. This is authentic. And when you see yourself acting out of that motivation, loving kindness, compassion, bodhicitta, renunciation, pure, pure renunciation, then watch. Take it as a hypothesis, just like a scientist. Be a scientist of existence, of your own existence. See on those occasions when your motivation is true as you can possibly make it, and then keep your eyes wide open and see whether reality rises up to meet you. Check those occasions when your motivation is not so true. It just gets caught up in icons and the stuff. Maybe you'll get lucky, maybe not, but watch. But come back. Try the greatest experiment that a human being can perform. I think really it's true. Try the greatest experiment. Try having absolutely authentic motivation, aspirations, and ideals, and live in accordance with them to your utmost, and then watch and see whether reality rises up to meet you. And you're going hand in hand with reality on the path to liberation. And you're not alone. And if you'd like to speak of Buddhas then, you can speak of reality, that's enough. But if you'd like to speak of Buddhism within the Buddhist context, then you say, aha, I have now focused my heart and soul, my full strength, my heart, my strength, my might, everything, on awakening. And I see that I'm not alone. That those who are there, those who have become absolutely real, who are the reality that they know, they're assisting me. They're rising up to meet me. And the word prayer actually means something. So, with that long preamble, now I'd like to use much fewer words, and you may test or embrace as much of that as you wish, because this is not a catechism, this is not an indoctrination, and the practice we'll be doing now can be practiced, I think, by anyone, but I think if one puts this hypothesis to the test, the practice we'll engage in momentarily will take on enormous depth and significance. So let's try it. I'll use now fewer words. This initial settling of the body, speech, and mind with which you are so familiar is equally important whether you're about to venture into shamatha practice, the four immeasurables, or really, frankly, any other type of meditation for life itself. Let's do so now. Settle the body with ease, stillness, and vigilance. Settle the flow of the breath in its natural rhythm. Set your mind at ease in stillness and clarity. when we first embark on the meditative cultivation of loving kindness or any of the other four immeasurables, it's very likely that in the early phases it will be largely conceptual, seem rather abstract, more mental, not much juice. But we slowly till the field of the mind in this way to soften it, to break it up, to break up old conceptual cognitive patterns, until eventually we tap into our own wellsprings. We tap into the heart that was there all along. And that which was done on the surface finds its immeasurably greater reflection from the depths. So let's be patient with this practice, because the cultivation of loving kindness is of infinite value and worthy of all striving. As we begin, let's focus on ourselves. And as we've done in the past, I invite you to bring forth consciously to your mind, what is your heart's desire? The vision of your own fulfillment. When I speak of your own fulfillment, I do not mean you as an isolated, independent individual. You are distinct and you are an individual, each of us is. But our very existence has always been and will always be one of profound interdependence. So once again, bring to mind your heart's desire as an individual in profound interdependence with all those around you. If you enjoy, have a facility for visualization, and you're so drawn to it, you may visualize the deepest dimension of your existence as Buddha nature, pristine awareness as a radiant orb of light at your heart. With each out-breath, arouse the yearning. May all barriers fall away. May all conducive circumstances arise, so that you may realize your highest ideals, your heart's desire, and breathe out this light from your heart, this light of loving kindness, let it fill your whole being. You may do this with or without visualization, as you wish. And imagine realizing your own fulfillment, here and now. According to your own worldview, what you believe to be true, you may call upon the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the enlightened beings. Call upon the kindness, the assistance of all sentient beings, all those around you, to assist you, to rise up and help you from moment to moment, day to day, in the pursuit of your highest ideals, your most authentic ideals. Or you may simply arouse the yearning of loving kindness. May you receive from the world around you, day to day, year to year, all that you truly need in order to proceed along the path to your own awakening. And imagine, if you will, the Buddhas responding to your call, the great Bodhisattvas. Imagine reality itself rising up to meet you, hand in hand, with each in-breath. Arouse this yearning of loving-kindness for yourself. May you receive all that you truly need to be well and happy. You may, if you wish, imagine light coming in from all sides, converging upon and permeating your body-mind. And if you will, imagine this actually being so. Keeping your eyes wide open, metaphorically, as you lead your life. See whether it may be so. Whether even adversity that arises, even encountering people who are acting out of mental affliction, even when this occurs. All of this from a deeper dimension, even in the midst of the ripening of karma, can be experienced and received as blessing, as an aid and assistance on your own path to awakening. Imagine it to be so, and keep your eyes open. This practice invites you to be an alchemist of life itself, with your own vision, your wisdom, your compassion, to deliberately and consciously transmute all that rises up to meet you, what reality dishes up, and like an alchemist, transmute it into gold or into nourishment to sustain you, to nourish you on your own path. And finally, in order to bring the greatest possible meaning and fulfillment to your own life, envision now with as much detail as you wish, what would you love to offer to the world, to those who are close to you, to those who are far away, in the short term, the long term? And if you enjoy visualizing, you have a knack, an ability for it, with each out-breath, as you arouse the yearning, may this be so. Imagine the light emitting from your heart, transforming into the goods, both tangible and intangible, that you would love to offer to the world around you. Breathe out your loving kindness with each breath. And let your imagination soar. In order to bring the greatest possible good to the world around you, how can you make this realistic? How can your capacity to be of service become completely unshackled, unveiled? is it not obvious that this could occur only by utterly dispelling all afflictions of the mind, delusion and all its derivatives, and fully tapping into your own inner resources of wisdom and compassion? If you will, in order to be of greatest possible benefit to the world around you, aspire for the greatest possible awakening. And let all of your yearning for happiness and freedom of suffering flow into this, the most sublime of all aspirations, bodhicitta. If you do indeed embrace this as your core aspiration, then once again it makes only common sense. It's only realistic. In order to realize this aspiration, it's only realistic to rely upon those who have already realized it, to entrust yourself to their example, the awakened ones, to entrust yourself to their teachings, the Dharma, and to entrust this most noble of aspirations to your fellow travelers, especially those who are further along the path than you. It's called taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. From now until perfect awakening is realized, then release all aspirations, all objects of the mind, and for a moment just rest in that pure luminosity of your own awareness. let's bring the session to a close. Digo ma soin. Voilà, so. So, this one's anonymous. I haven't read it yet. So when practicing awareness of awareness, especially after the oscillation with breath, it is hard to let go of awareness of the moment of the breath and be able to attend completely to resting awareness. Feels as if the practice has become awareness of the body of the breath so long as that is hanging on. Advice, please. Yeah, the easiest way to deal with that is stop breathing. But if that doesn't work out too well, then we have to go for plan B. As I said, I'm back. With my ridiculous sense of humor. Here we go. Better and worse. Until not death, but June 12th, do us part. The fact that you're still aware of the breathing probably goes hand in hand with the fact that you're still aware that you have a body. It goes hand in hand with you're still aware of that there are birds chirping, there's ambient noise in the environment, hand in hand with the fact that if your eyes are open, you're aware of visual impressions, which means you haven't achieved stage 7 or 8 yet. So we have we all, to varying extents, have engaged in the practice of mindfulness of breathing, and it becomes a habit, of course. Do anything a lot, it becomes a habit. But habits in meditative practice are to be picked up and put down. So cultivating loving kindness as a contemplative practice is something, but we don't do it all the time. Sometimes you have to balance your checkbook. You know, it's not really, may all my numbers be well and happy, it's just numbers. And so we pick up and we put down, you know? And so, as we've become accustomed to, spent at least dozens of hours in these last 7 weeks or so in mindfulness of breathing, of course, it's bound to impinge. But the point is very simple. It won't vanish. Your awareness of the breathing won't simply disappear because now you've decided you want to be aware of awareness. But marginalize it and simply say, yes, breath, I notice you. But in fact, you're not of interest right now. And neither is the vision, neither is the auditory, neither are any other tactile sensations. If there's any smells in the room, I'm not interested in them either. It's simply a deliberate withdrawal of interest. A withdrawal of interest, right? And so it would be like being very rude. Be like being very rude to a person who's talking and talking and talking and just telling them, you can go on and talk if you like, but I'm not going to pay attention to you anymore. That'd be very rude. Sometimes it's almost necessary when cold callers, you know, say, thank you very much, but I'm really not interested. I just hang up. And I don't let them get the whole spiel. I politely say I'm not interested, and I hang up. And so it's kind of like that, though. And that is, if these other impressions keep on coming in, of course they do. We haven't totally funneled all of our awareness into just mental awareness yet. So they arise, but just let them be. Any thoughts that come up, let them go in awareness of awareness. What other sensory impressions arise, let them be. But again, this practice is withdrawing from them. They'll still arise, but don't be concerned. It would be astonishing. It would startle me if as soon as you decided to disengage from the breath and the oscillation and just focusing on awareness of awareness, you reported, and in that session, I became totally oblivious of the fact that I was breathing. I say, how did that happen? What did you do? I would be stunned. So I'm not stunned. I'm feeling very relaxed. So that's that. Here's one from Ilsa. Could you explain more extensively what you mean by saying that at home we should be real? At home, here, between sessions, during sessions, or for that matter, when we're in deep sleep and when we're dreaming. To be real is better than being unreal, because unreal is acting out of delusion, and that's the very source of suffering. So what does it mean? It's a perfect, and this is from a philosopher, so I know I better be careful here. but also from a spiritual friend, I know. Let's start from the opposite end. Let's start from deep sleep. Let's start from deep sleep, non-lucid deep sleep, where frankly, I think it's pretty safe to say, you don't know anything. There's no explicit knowledge of anything. I mean, you don't even know you're asleep, so you don't know anything beyond that. You got nothing. You're not misapprehending anything, because you're not apprehending anything. Consciousness has gone implicit, the sword has been put in its sheath, the substrate consciousness has slipped into the substrate. The burner has gone into the pilot light. You've heard all the metaphors now that I have to offer. So that's not being real. You don't know what's going on. You're oblivious. Become lucid in dreamless sleep, and now you become real. You're experiencing something. The substrate, that's actually happening. The substrate is arising, and you're realizing it with the substrate consciousness. And if you're in deep sleep and you're lucid, you're deep sleep and you know that you're deep asleep, then you're real. You got it. It's like my looking over at Mugi and say, is that a Mongolian man? Yes, that's real, because he is a Mongolian. I got it right. And so if you're lucid in dreamless sleep, you got it right. You got something right, rather than not getting anything right, but not anything wrong, because you didn't get anything. You got something right. Congratulations. You just tapped into a pretty interesting and pretty deep dimension of consciousness. Now let's imagine that somehow, and usually some inexplicable, and not usually cognizant fashion, or conscious fashion, that symmetry, that evenness, that homogeneity of the substrate consciousness, symmetry is broken, to use a lovely metaphor from physics. The symmetry is broken. The substrate catalyzes, and suddenly there's like a magician who brings just something out of nothing, like a wristwatch out of thin air. Suddenly you have a dreamscape. It's not only in front of you, it's all around you. Whoa! Substrate just became activated. Hello, dreamscape. And if you come lucidly from the dreamless sleep to the dream, you come in knowing that whatever persona, embodied or disembodied, in which you may have manifested in this dream, you know you're dreaming. You know whatever persona that is a dreamed persona, a concoction, a creation, an emergence of substrate consciousness. You know that all that is appearing to you is arising out of the substrate. You recognize these effulgences of the substrate and the substrate consciousness as effulgences or creations of the substrate and the substrate consciousness. You got it right. It's real. Congratulations. If on the contrary, you unknowingly, out of non-lucid dreamless sleep, unknowingly, mysteriously, with no identifiable beginning, come into a non-lucid dream, a little microcosm of samsara. Oh, it's such a perfect microcosm of samsara. You don't know you're dreaming. And you not only don't know, but you're actively misapprehending, because you think what's happening around you is really out there. That's why all the emotions. We don't have those kind of emotions when we're watching a cartoon. If an adult watches a cartoon, a Mickey Mouse cartoon, and Mickey Mouse is about to fall over a cliff, we don't go, oh, don't fall, Mickey, don't fall. 911, Mickey's gonna fall. You know, we don't do that because we recognize it's a cartoon. Little kids may. But, you know, they're entering some pretty serious cognitive fusion there. You know, that's why they enjoy it. But we get over it. And so, if we're non-lucid in the dream, we fundamentally got everything wrong, which means we're not real. That is, there is a reality to dream reality, but we're not getting that. We're thinking it's something that it is not. So we mistook it. We're not real. That's why we suffer so much. That's the only reason, frankly, why we suffer in dreams. Insofar as you're lucid, you don't have to suffer in dreams at all. Let a crocodile bite you in two, leaving your two legs flopping around in the water, and your head and the top part of your torso over here disconnected, and he got you know, all your vital organs down here. You don't have to suffer from that. You say, hey, finish your meal. Don't play with your food. Finish what's on your plate. There are two legs over there, two drumsticks, and there's a neck and a head over here. Finish your meal. You know, what's it to you? It's one rainbow chomping down on another rainbow. There's no suffering in that, insofar as you're lucid. And so that's real. When you're lucid, it's real. And then we come to the waking state, get real with respect to your own mind. As Malcolm often just recently shared with our Dharma sister, she needs it, we all need it. Recognize that thoughts are thoughts. The thoughts are not the reference of the thoughts. Thoughts are no reality other than the thoughts. They are just the reality of being a thought, and that's it. as a dream is just a dream. It's not a reality of something else. It's just a dream, 100%. And a thought has no more substance than a dream. And it doesn't necessarily represent anything more real than a dream does. Thoughts are just thoughts, mental images, and so forth. And so get real with respect to your own mind. Recognize mental events as mental events. In the waking state, it's called settling the mind in its natural state. It's called citta satipatthana, close application of mindfulness to the mind. So you get real with respect to your own mind. And thereby, lo and behold, you suffer less and less and less, and then not at all, because of your own mind. Why? Because you got real. You don't have to suffer in a dream. There's nothing in the dream that makes you suffer. And there's nothing in the mind in terms of the thoughts, the appearances, and so forth that arise in the mind that compel you to suffer. It's grasping. It's misapprehension. It's delusion. That's what sets us up, makes us vulnerable. And even with respect to the body, that one's one of the last ones to go. But it does go. It does go. For an Arya Bodhisattva, for an Arhat, pain arises, but it's just more like sensations arising in space. That's why these great Arya Bodhisattvas, we hear so many accounts in the Mahayana Sutras, giving away limbs like they're giving away carrots or potatoes, you know, giving them away. The Buddha, the Jataka account of the Buddha as a Bodhisattva, giving his body away to the tigress. What it doesn't say, and he screamed in agony as it happened. It doesn't say that. And for the Arya Bodhisattvas, it is said, Mahayana teachings, Madhyamic in particular, once you become an Arya Bodhisattva, you're a Bodhisattva, direct realization of emptiness, you can give away your limbs, give away your body like you give away a bag of vegetables. Here's the real analogy. As if you were in the midst of a lucid dream. And somebody comes to you in the midst of a lucid dream and says, oh, Tsepela, you've got such a great arm, and look at me, I don't have a right arm. Can I have your right arm? She just happens to have a hacksaw handy. Sure, you want just the right arm? You want me to give him the left arm? It'll be harder to give you the left arm because I need a cut with something. Maybe I can use my foot. How many arms do you need? You know, lucid dream, whack them off. How about a leg? Because, you know, I'm kind of an octopus. I can regenerate anything I want here. So, the more real we are, the less we suffer. Not being real is getting caught up in obsessive, compulsive, delusional thoughts. Not getting real in the waking state is reifying, glomming onto, reifying, grasping objects as inherently existent, subjects inherently existent, me, ourselves, each of us as an individual, inherently existent. Delusion sets us up. Delusion sets us out in a turkey shoot. A turkey shoot is we have a bunch of turkeys out there and a whole bunch of men with guns. Delusion just sets us up as a turkey shoot. We're just waiting to be shot down by something, one thing or another. In the meantime, all we think about is gobble, 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 gobble. So direct experience, is that experiencing without words or concepts or images? Is that what is meant by non-conceptual? Good, a wonderful, very deep philosophical question. And we have only one more, so I think maybe, I haven't read the other one yet from Gonzalo and Ivan. Yeah, this is something where there's a profound difference between modern psychology, most modern philosophers, I believe. I mean, that's maybe a risky statement. But from cognitive psychology, I've engaged with them a lot. I have asked them. They've spoken at length on this. I remember in the last Mind and Life conference, just last April, a year ago last April, this came up. And this very eminent cognitive psychologist from Princeton University made the comment that all of our experience is conceptual. There is just no such thing as non-conceptual experience. And that is our concepts, our words, our conceptual conditioning, our verbal linguistic conditioning saturates all of our conscious experience. Dreams, all waking experience of our minds, there is just, it's like oil on paper. It just saturates the whole paper. And so there just is no distinction. And I think she's speaking for, and I understand why she's saying this. This is not a foolish position. I think it's wrong. I think it's limited, but it's not foolish. Certainly not unintelligent. But the idea here is that we are so conditioned by thoughts and by words, everything we experience is saturated by it. And so the notion of mystics from around the world throughout the ages, speaking of, you know, utterly transcending all concepts. Well, the postmodernists, and I've read a lot of accounts of this, I'm a religious studies scholar, when I used to be a scholar of religious study, the postmodernists just throw that out. They just forget it. You never transcend your concepts. And all of these mystical experiences, ineffable, blah, 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 It's just conditioning. It's just, you've just basically conditioned yourself to some highfalutin state. Highfalutin means very esoteric, oh, kind of experience of what you were trained to believe all along. And they say it's ineffable. Well, okay, whatever. So that's the postmodernist reduction or reductionist attitude to experience that is said to be by contemplatives East and West for millennia as absolutely transcending concepts. The postmodernist, who has no experience of this by and large, they just read books, says not possible. Psychologists have no experience of this, therefore they say it's impossible. Colorblind art historians actually write books about only black and white art. Or if they did, that's all they'd write about. Because after all, colors don't exist. Why? Because they don't experience them. And that's it. If I don't experience it, nobody experiences. So it's a type of myopia, frankly. But so there it is. The contemplative traditions of the world, and I'll just spoke on Buddhism, says, sure, what you're talking about is samsaric mind. That's all you've ever experienced. Therefore, because you're closed-minded, that's all you think it exists. Okay, have a nice day. Next, now people with open minds, let us consider, and now it's not a leap of faith. We've been doing this all the way along in all the shamatha practices, let alone vipassana. But in all the shamatha practices, what are we seeking to do here? From the first breath, releasing the obsessive compulsive delusional disorder. See if we can not be so compulsively inundated by concepts every doggone moment of waking state and every moment of every dream. To see if we can have some intervals where it's quiet, that we're not just stuck in a cacophonous loony bin all day and all night, except for when we're unconscious and we can't even enjoy it because we're unconscious. So the possibility of being conscious and quiet. Not absolutely. So when you know, you've already heard, when you achieve shamatha, it's non-conceptual, but not absolutely. But it's really quiet. It's really, really quiet. So we're right now on a path of discovering through experience, rather than simply laying down dogmatic assumptions, how we can become more immediate, how our encounters with our breath, with our thoughts and images, with our dreams, in the waking state, with the physical environment and other sentient beings, how it can be more immediate. How can we attend more closely? That's a gradient. This is something to be explored. This is not a religious belief. It's not blind. It's not a leap. It's to what extent, when we're attending to another person, are we filtering everything through our expectations, memories, desires, hopes, fears, blah, 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 and to what extent are we really there in the moment? Of course, there's some concepts, but less, that we're attending in the moment, really fully present with another human being. And we say, that's not like before. That's less conceptual. We attend to awareness, and we see that's less conceptual. We cultivate loving kindness, first very conceptual, and then, oh, much less conceptual. This is experience. This is not religion or dogma. So there's a gradient there. Achieve shamatha, very quiet. Subliminal structuring by concepts, yep. Verbalization, nope, not unless you want to talk. And it's voluntary, right? Go beyond shamatha, but now with the muscle, the might of shamatha, the ability, the freedom to be quiet when you want to be, apply that to vipassana. And there in the Theravada tradition, when a person becomes sotapan, stream enterer, realizes nirvana, or nibbana for the first time. Non-conceptual. So here's the answer. Unmediated, non-conceptual, non-dual. It's not nibbana over there and me over here. It's not nibbana conditioned, structured by my Theravada Buddhist ideas. That's not the assertion. No, this is not a Theravada nibbana, not a Buddhist nibbana or a Mahayana nibbana. It's not a Buddhist emptiness. You're tapping into the unconditioned, which is beyond all concepts. When you have a direct unmediated realization, it's not mediated by language or concepts. Therefore, those coming out simply cannot convey what they've experienced with any thought transmission or any verbalization. So that's exactly what's meant. This is an area that is simply beyond the scope of psychology at this point. For a very simple reason. They're not running the experiments. It's not part of it. I mean, maybe a little bit in transpersonal psychology. But they're not running the experiments. So if you're not running the experiments, if you don't have the technology to pose the question and get a real answer whether there are in fact planets revolving around other stars, then you might say, hey, we have no evidence. There are no planets around any other stars. Why? We haven't seen them. Do you have the technology to actually test that? Nope. But why are you asking? We haven't seen them. Next question. I just find that closed-minded dogmatism by any name. So there we are. So that's what it means. Conceptually unmediated. Is it true or false? Well, we don't have to believe. We can try to have a less and less mediated engagement with another person. Or with a sunset. With our breath. With our own awareness. With our own thoughts. And see, does it have to be as conceptually dense as it was? Can it be thinner? Can it be thinner? And is it thinner? Are we just becoming more stupid? Or is there another type of knowing? In the Christian tradition, one of the most lovely phrases is the cloud of unknowing. Or one of my favorite writers, really of all time in the Christian tradition, in terms of his brilliance and the depth of his experience, was Nicholas of Cusa. And he spoke of the knowing with respect to which all other knowing is not knowing. In the Dzogchen tradition, they speak of the whole of ordinary experience as being non-existent. They just punch it. Tsongkhapa gives so much nuance and subtlety and so forth. But the Dzogchen has come in and say, everything you experience doesn't exist at all. Like, whap. What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? This doesn't exist. What does exist? I don't get it. What? You mean I don't exist? What? You know? It's kind of like, that's right, everything you think you know, it's wrong. Gautama, are you a celestial being? No. Earth spirit? No. Man? No. You look like a man. Your mother was a woman. She was a human being. How come? I'm awake, you're not. Hola, so. Gonzalo and Ivan, we have 10 minutes. Both while in deep sleep and while achieving, when achieving shamatha, we rest in the substrate consciousness. When you've achieved shamatha. Yeah, deep sleep, you get it with a 5-watt bulb, maybe a 10-watt bulb. Rest in the substrate consciousness with shamatha, 1,000-watt bulb, which is to simply say the luminosity of substrate consciousness is unveiled. Could this mean that having achieved shamatha replaces sleeping? Depends on what you want. When you have achieved shamatha, you have greater freedom and no less freedom. No less freedom. If you'd like to, once you've achieved shamatha, can you daydream? Yes, you can. You just do it consciously. But it doesn't. But you know, daydreaming can be really fun and very creative, very useful, right? And so you don't have any less freedom. You just have a whole lot more freedom. So there are two types of yogis. There are yogis who wish to make daytime experience their primary platform for proceeding along the path. And there are yogis, it's a minority, but they're there. They certainly have a voice, who wish to make sleep their primary platform for proceeding along the path. This becomes very explicit. I just alluded to this earlier and I won't elaborate now, but the 6 bardos, 6 intermediate periods, or I call them transitional phases. Practicing shamatha vipassana is called the transitional phase, the bardo. The bardo of living, it really hones in right on practicing shamatha vipassana. There's the bardo of dreaming, there's the bardo of dying, there's the bardo of dhammata, a very brief interval following the clear light of death prior to just scooting along into your next bardo. There's the bardo of becoming, and so forth. So there's 6 of them. Each of these, as I mentioned very briefly, it can be a platform, a launching pad to proceed along the path to enlightenment. So there are some, and it's a matter of personal predilection, of giftedness, of being gifted, having a gift or talent, native ability. Some are just, and I've met many people like this, some just find it pretty easy to have lucid dreams. They find before becoming great yogis, they can fall asleep lucidly, they can enter into lucid dreamless sleep. I just received an email from one of my students, had a 45-minute long lucid dream. I don't know what she must look at her dream wristwatch. It's a Rolex, it must be keeping good time. Is it digital or is it a wind-up? Let's take it apart. Oh, nothing inside. That means it's definitely right. Right? But Stephen LaBerge, I'm just wandering all over the place here, but Stephen LaBerge made it very interesting. He, or whether it was one of his colleagues, was within this scientific discipline of studying dreams and lucid dreams, they did find out something quite significant, and that is your experienced sense of the passage of time in a dream corresponds very closely to your experienced sense of passage of time in the waking state. Now that makes sense. The question came up visually. I put it over here. Somebody asked, maybe it was Kathleen, about time. What's the time? Yeah, you're right where you should be. It was a person coming in from 10 o'clock. What about time? And my comment, now to give a very brief recapitulation of that, is our experience of time is very closely connected with the flow of concepts, of memory and anticipation, our sense of being placed in time. And then that's moving, but we're weaving that ongoing sense of flow of time. That was the past, this is the future about to happen, in a few minutes we'll go off and have dinner and so forth. So that flow of concepts, of memory, and of anticipation, right? It's very similar in a dream as it is in the waking state. So therefore, passage of time, experience passage of time in the dream, waking state about the same. So this student of mine had a 40, I would say, I take her at face value. She's a very smart woman, very experienced meditator now. 45 minutes. That's good lab. She got a really good lease on her mind laboratory. So some people like her, and I know quite a number of other people, very gifted for that. So they might think, well, once I've achieved shamatha, gosh, I don't want to stop sleeping. That'd be so too bad. I couldn't lease the best lab anymore. I can always go to shamatha, but it's hard to visualize, you know, out of shamatha, visualize with the detail of a full-fledged dream that's just coming up spontaneously, where everything you're experiencing seems about as real as in the waking state. Gosh, don't let me out of that. And the having shamatha and going into deep sleep, oh, that's a double whammy. You know, then I get maybe they compound interest. So, I don't want to sleep less. And so I mentioned, I think I must have this yogi. I hope he's still alive. I don't know. I never met him, but in Shimla, in northern India. His platform was dreaming, and his dream yoga, really adept. That was his primary platform. He would sleep as much as he could. He was a professional siesta guy. Siesta day, siesta night, I think I could sleep. And he'd be out, you know. Oh, boy, you know. He's back to his lab, you know, best possible place. He can practice stage regeneration, practice stage of completion. He can practice Dzogchen. He can practice, he can even practice dream yoga. And so, for some people, that's what they want to do. Now, Yangtang Rinpoche, one of my teachers, who Gyatso Rinpoche assured me has achieved shamatha and vipassana, and is a Dzogchen master, and he's, when I last saw him, 74, 75, something like that, slept an hour and a half, just kind of a little bit head tilting, like that. And who knows what he was doing? All they could see from outside is he wasn't sitting quite erect anymore. And then he'd be up. Dzogchen Rinpoche, whom I trained with years ago, he seemed to just fall asleep when he felt like it. He was again, he was really incredible lama. He called, two other monks, I was a monk at the time, 1978. He would teach whenever people wanted him to teach. So he had one group of, Geshe Rapnin was there, Geshe Zopa was there, some other, I think Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche was there. I think he was, can't remember. But he had a cluster of lamas and monks with him, and they just chatted until 1 o'clock. We knew that the three of us would get a personal teaching from him. But he said, it'll be after I spend time with, you know, these monks and lamas. And so we waited and waited and waited. It got to 1 o'clock in the morning. And all the monks and lamas left. And Dzogchen Rinpoche said, okay, come on, now you guys come in. He began a teaching at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then he's teaching us clear as a bell. He looked, anybody who's seen like Lord of the Rings or imagines Merlin, you know, the great sorcerer and the King Arthur, he was Merlin. He was like 75 when I last saw him. I translated for him on a number of occasions in Europe and in America. But he was straight as a pillar and had little golden glasses and a white goatee beard. You just expected him to start just doing some magic any moment. And apparently he did. He displayed some quite extraordinary things in Tibet. To us, he just displayed phenomenal knowledge of Buddhism. So he invited us in at 1 o'clock. So there he was sitting ramrod straight, sitting on his bed. It's very common. And we're sitting on the floor listening, receiving the teaching. And then, I don't know, maybe it took an hour and a half or so. And then, in the midst, right in the middle of the teaching, he paused and he went like this. For those listening to podcast, he just quietly wilted, head went down, he went to sleep. He paused, but then he went out. He slept for maybe 10, 15 minutes, and then continued the teaching. That was his night's sleep. So he would just sleep when he wanted to. And Geshe Rabten and others in back in Baksadwar, in eastern India, in East Bengal, way back in the 1960, 61, 62, around then. That was one of the most phenomenal gatherings of lamas ever in the history of the planet. Because this is where the Indian government had all these hundreds, maybe a few thousand monks and lamas, tulkus, rinpoches from all the schools. They, you know, those who managed to escape, they came down to India, and the Indian government needed, what do you do when you wind up having 3,000 lamas and monks on your hands? Well, you put them in a concentration camp. What would you do? And so they put them in a very nice concentration camp that the English had for people like Gandhi. So they're not places of torture. That was just places to get them out of the mainstream. Go away, please. We're going to put them in a shoebox. So they had this empty prison camp because Gandhi won and kicked all the British out, those who wanted, you know, they got their independence. So they had an empty prison way off in the boonies in the jungle. So he said, what do you do when you have 3,000 or 4,000 lamas? Put them in a prison with no key. You know, they can leave anytime they want and feed them and let them do their lama stuff. So they had this incredible density of extraordinary lamas from all traditions and monks from all schools. And they all, I've heard the accounts of many, many lamas. They lived in incredible harmony. And they had lamas giving empowerments and all these great lamas giving teachings to other monks. They just established themselves an ecumenical monastery right on the spot until eventually the Indian government gave them large plots of land down in the south of India. And then they established Sera and Ganja and Depung, Sakya monasteries and the Namdurling and so forth and so on. They gave them plots of land of raw jungle and they created their monasteries down there. But boy, I would have loved to be there in Baksadwar in East India. But what Dzogchen Rinpoche, I know I'm just going all over the place, it's 601, but Dzogchen Rinpoche really developed, got a reputation during that time, because he was one of the seniors. And so he was just got the reputation that Dzogchen Rinpoche would just give teachings anytime, 24/7. You know, just call him at 4 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, anytime. And then when he wasn't needed, nobody wants teachings right now? No? He'd catch his 20 winks. And then somebody said, Rinpoche, what? Ready to teach again? Okay. Nobody? Okay. So Yangtan Rinpoche, an hour and a half. Dzogchen Rinpoche, just whenever he felt like it. Gyaltsepche, the two principal disciples of Tsongkhapa, just gave up on sleeping. And I've heard from multiple sources, Anilak, can you confirm or do you know? Lama Zubar Rinpoche just doesn't sleep. That's what I keep on hearing for decades now. Just doesn't sleep, you know. So some go that way, that they just have the waking experience, be their platform 24/7. And others are just trying to squeeze the sleeping for all it's worth, you know, and that'll be their platform. So one can't say. Time running out, let's see if we can just, if we achieve the fourth or fifth stage of shamatha path, we would have gained some degree of relaxation and stability. I sure hope so. Therefore, is it possible to continue our practice and eventually achieve shamatha within the practice of lucid dreaming? Not likely, not within lucid dreaming. Because, I mean, this woman had a really nice lucid dream of 45 minutes. But when you achieve shamatha, you'll certainly want your sessions to go longer than 45 minutes. So if your shamatha practice is confined within dreaming, the longest dream is about an hour and a half. That's maxed out, and that's the last dreams in the early morning hours. So overall, just as lucid dream yoga is a type of vipassana, it's all about insight, getting real. And vipassana is not the foundation for shamatha. Shamatha is the foundation for vipassana. And you cultivate, and there's certainly a synergy. So it's not absolutely hierarchical. Develop some degree of insight in vipassana that will help you in your shamatha. But there is a hierarchy. Shamatha is a foundation for vipassana, not vice versa. Shamatha is a foundation for dream yoga, not vice versa. So that would be the answer to that, okay? Clear? Good. So, let's have dinner, and don't get your hopes up about free ice cream. Not likely. Not likely.